Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 1st of July 2012. My name is TRP Watson and this week I am joined by Gareth James, Rev Stan and Shauna Jones. We're now going to talk about Birthday, which is a new play by Joe Penhall downstairs at the Royal Court. This play features two characters, Lisa and Ed, played by Steve Mangan and Lisa Dillon, or Ed and Lisa in that case. They're trying to have another baby, but unfortunately Lisa can't have another baby, possibly because of the traumatic experience of having their first one, possibly because she's now a career woman with a good job. So in this world, they have introduced the ability for men to have babies. They are fitted with an artificial womb, a small spigot somewhere in their bowel, and they are given... able to have children. They are able to sort of carry a child to term. So what we have is Ed's labour, where he waits in a hospital to give birth. And I think what we see here is an awful lot of the kind of role reversal, where you imagine what would be said by a man. What would actually be said by a woman, the way that women are, you sort of hear that women are treated, but this scene from a man's point of view, so you get a lot more anger and you know, a lot more shouting. And I don't know if you sort of wonder if it's you see whether or not it's unreasonable or whether or not the man is being unreasonable, because women have to put up with this sort of thing. Now, in this play, we have two other characters who are the doctor, Natasha, played by Louise Brearley, and an African nurse called Joyce, played by Luella Gideon, who there's slightly unsympathetic portrayals, perhaps. I mean, I think, although I do think the doctor is quite a lot of fun and gets to have quite a lot of fun with it. Now, I should say this play is really rather funny. I mean, everyone was laughing and I had a good laugh at it too, although I did get the sneaking suspicion that it is rather slight and a disgruntled critic could really lay into it. I don't think any of them have yet. Now, Gareth, what did you think of this?
I think that even though the device is a bit implausible, you know, the idea that you can, you know, the technology's moved on and a man can carry and give birth to a child by cesarean section is implausible. But, I mean, it's a device for exploring the sort of issues of childbirth from the perspective of both sexes, really. And as you say, you know, lots of what you've ever heard a woman say in pregnancy are now hearing out of a man's mouth, and lots of what you've heard a man say during a woman's pregnancy you now hear coming out of the woman's mouth. So that does deliver fabulous opportunities for great comedy. So it's certainly true this is a very, very funny 90 minutes in the theatre. And you've got what you'd expect with the role reversal, really. You know, Ed is humiliated and patronised and humoured by his wife and the hospital staff. And of course, being a man, he treats it as if it's the worst thing that's ever happened to anyone ever in the world. Said he is a man, I agree with you. It's just it doesn't really go anywhere. You know, it's not got a lot of depth. I think Susanna Clapp in The Observer today was quite interesting, because she said that he's now had quite a few plays where he gets a great idea, lays the subject out, and then somehow shies away of doing much with it. And that is exactly what I think he's done here, really. So even though it's an entertaining and diverting 90 minutes, and is very well staged, very well designed, very well acted, that's all it is. And it doesn't have the sort of depth of a lot of the other plays we've seen at the Royal Court of late in the last few years, you know. So it's no Jerusalem or no Posh or no Tribes, or, you know, it doesn't have the depth of any of those things. But, you know, I enjoyed the 90 minutes. There were times when I had to turn my head, and I did on occasion clinch my buttocks. But it was, you know, it was an entertaining time. I would agree with you, though, that I think it's a bit unfair on the NHS and the doctor and the African nurse. And what I didn't like about it is I felt it was more pointed at the nurse and the character of the nurse and the character of the doctor rather than the institution of the NHS. And I felt for those two people because, you know, these people seem to me to be people trying their best against the odds, as it were. And I thought that was a bit unfair. But I gather from interviews with Joe Penhor and Steve Mangan that, you know, there's more than a little real experience in it, as they're both, I think, new fathers. So I wouldn't, you know, I mean, I didn't regret going. I would probably recommend it to people if you just want a good entertaining 90 minutes. But I suspect I won't be thinking much about it for an awfully long time. I think it will go from my memory longer before many other new plays of the Royal Court.
Now, you didn't like Lee Stillen in what is Not of the Heart. And you do mention in your review that you slightly got you her back into your favour, slightly anyway.
It was better, but I'm still, you know, I'm still yet to be convinced that Lisa Dillon has much range as an actress, to be honest. You know, so it was in this role, you know, as a kind of middle class career woman mother, I think she was fine. You know, to be honest, I thought the supporting actors were better, and Steve Mangan is exceptional. But it certainly wasn't the sort of dreadful, what I thought dreadful acting in Not of the Heart. But then again, she had a dreadful play to deal with, so that's a little bit different, really. So if, you know, of the four, to me, you know, she's the weaker of the four. But you know, I didn't feel the same. You know, I didn't feel angry or annoyed about it. I suppose I just felt a bit more indifferent, really.
Rev Stan, I'm trying to work out if you felt differently to Gareth on this, whether or not it was a play where you felt that because you've got the role reversal, you've got the man making a fuss in a way that a woman perhaps would be ignored. And I think that's one of the things, you know, with the kind of worked about this play. What did you think of this play?
Well, I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it. Obviously, it's very funny. It was very entertaining, but I enjoyed it also because I felt that it challenged your perception. When Stephen Mangan was rolling around in the bed in the pains of labour, there was this thought at the back of my head going, oh, God's sake, just grow up, you know, get on with it. You know, women give birth all the time. And then I thought, well, actually, if it had been a woman in bed writhing around in the labour pains, I would have felt far more sympathetic, and I wouldn't have been thinking, oh, for God's sake, stop making a fuss. And I liked it because it did challenge my own prejudices about sort of, you know, the male and female role in childbirth. And the flip side of that was when Lisa Dillon as the wife was coming back to him and saying, I go out work, I work all day, I support you. And there was this part of me that was thinking, yeah, you know, that's right. She is going out working, you know, stop having a go. But then if those words had been coming out of a man's mouth, I would have bristled at it and thought, hang on a minute, your wife's sort of, you know, pregnant. She's having to carry around this weight, go through, you know, give up all these, give up drink, you know, give up all the things, you know, that lots of stuff to sort of keep the baby healthy and, you know, all these, you've swollen ankles and the rest of it. So I really enjoyed it for the fact that it did actually make me stop and think about my prejudices around the sex role stereotyping and why I might... why I've been conditioned to sort of be more sympathetic to sort of women in that position. And I thought it was very telling as well when the medical staff are being very dismissive. And it feels more, I mean, I suppose as a woman, I probably would have felt that anyway, but I think it has more, again, this is prejudice, it has more of an impact when it's a man and he's not being taken seriously and he's being patronised, because you don't expect that. And again, I think that exposes the sort of stereotype about the sexes, I think. And I really enjoyed it for that. It's very well written, very well observed, very well imagined, because obviously this isn't something that could actually happen. And it had a lot of, it was very thought provoking. It had me thinking a lot about sort of my, why I was reacting to it in a certain way.
We're now going to talk about The Only True History of Lizzie Finn by Sebastian Barry. This is Sebastian Barry's 1995 play, and one of his sort of fairly early plays. It's been presented at the Southwark Playhouse and it's being directed by Blanche McIntyre, who directed Foxfinder and at the Finborough, and When Did You Last See My Mother last year at the Trafalgar Studios, which was really rather well done. This play is about a can-can dancer, I suppose, called Lizzie Finn, a musical artiste who has gained quite a reputation and quite a level of fame in Western Supermare around about the turn of the century. I think on the blurb it says 1902, but we have a character who enters her life, and he's just come back from the Boer War, which I think makes it, we'll put it 10 years later, sort of 1901. And this young man, this young Irishman, comes back to meet Lizzie Finn and sort of sweeps her off her feet slightly. He's rather proper and rather prim, but they fall in love, and she goes back to sort of be the mistress of his rather grand house. He comes from an upright Protestant family. I'm not entirely sure where in Ireland. I didn't look it up. And Castlemaine, I think they mentioned. So I think it's sort of Northern Ireland. So we've got a lot of. So we're sort of talking Protestant and established church. There's quite a lot of that in there. And she's something of an interloper, although I don't think she's actually a Catholic in this. And she's seen as an interloper and having a rather shady past, having been in the musicals and on the boards and doing can-can dancing, and she doesn't seem to be accepted by the locals, but they just seem to get on with it. And it's also compounded is that her husband he has a secret about the Boer War and what exactly he did. He lost his three brothers there, and he is rather broken up about that, but he has a deeper secret than that, which we don't hear until towards the end. It sounds a little bit more interesting than it really was. It was nicely acted, and I thought really, you know, quite well done for a sort of a small scale play. But it didn't really do anything. It was an interesting way to pass the time, but I didn't think that I really wanted to. I wanted it to be harder. I wanted it to be a much stronger play, and it really wasn't. It was a bit too quiet and a bit too. It's a bit too gentle, you know. There's potential there for some real fire and some real yelling and some real, you know, acting, and it was all kind of pulling punches all over the place. Rev Stan, what did you think of it?
I think I agree. The title of the play, I think, is very intriguing, The Only True History of Lizzie Finn, and it immediately got me thinking, oh, you know, is she going to be misunderstood? Is there going to be some sort of major tragedy? And I must admit, the sort of final bit where sort of everything comes to light was a bit, oh, is that it? And I was really sort of quite surprised. I think it is a victim of its staging. I mean, this may just be me, but the way the stage is set, it's three quite deep steps. There's a fourth bottom step, which is water with floating candles in it, which is barely used, and I'm not quite sure why it's there. And because a lot of the scenes are very short, the actors are running up and down the steps and constantly coming and going. And I felt like they were sort of, you spent more time watching them coming and going and worrying about whether they were going to trip up and down the steps or not than them actually sort of delivering their lines and telling the story. And then I found the floating candles moving in the water quite fascinating, and then was worried by for one part they had flames coming up from the middle of the stage, and I was very worried about that when the ladies sort of swishing around with their long dresses and thinking, oh my god, somebody's going to have an accident in a minute. And it just all felt very distracting from what was actually going on. So I think you're right. I don't think it has enough teeth, doesn't have enough bite, and I think the staging was a little bit. It was, you know, interesting to see the Southwark Playhouse pulling out all the stops and having water and flames, but I don't think it was necessary in this. And I think if it had been done far more simply, I would have got more engaged with the characters. It felt very bitty, and I didn't feel that I could really get to grips with, you know, you felt like you had hints of Lizzie's tough past, and you didn't really get a sense of what was going on in the husband's head. And I just wasn't as fully engaged in it as I could have been, I don't think. And I'd like to see it sort of put on without steps and flames and water and done a bit more simply, I think.
This week, Equity have written to the 43 artistic directors of subsidised theatre, drawing their attention to various gender imbalances in programming, of the fact that many more male actors than female actors get work on stage, and especially in the subsidised sector, where you'd hope it was sort of closer to equal. This is partially because historically we have plays are written with a lot more men than women in them. It's always been a bit of a problem, but it's also whether or not it's actually. But it is important, I think, that it is being addressed slightly, and that we are looking more into this, because I'm certainly somebody who tends to notice, possibly rather embarrassing to admit, I tend to notice actresses more than I do actors, or male actors rather than female actors, and it's or the other way around anyway. I have noticed, that I often see many more men than women on stage, and and I sometimes wonder, what can be done about this. And these letters produced a blog on the writer Stella Duffy, where she talked about, especially about the Hampstead Theatre in particular, where they've just finished having the Chariots of Fire, which had very few women on stage, but rather a lot of men, and they're just about to have Propeller, the all-male Shakespearean theatre company, in for a couple of weeks to do that, and that's Edward, and that of course is Edward Hall's company, Propeller, and he's the director of the artistic director of the Hampstead Theatre. So it's sort of using his contacts to produce all-male programming, and we are seeing quite a lot of this. Where we're doing all-male programming, we also have it for musicals. The Union Theatre has made quite a business of doing Gilbert and Sullivan all-male, and although it's been worked very well, you do sort of wonder, well, where are either the all-female roles, or why just don't we have sort of more women represented? Now, one of the things that's been pointed out in the talk about it, there was additional coverage of this in The Guardian, and quite a lot of comments, and one or two of the comments pointed out that there are an awful lot of women working in the theatre, certainly working backstage and working sort of front of house at the theatre, and you do kind of wonder why. And they're increasingly in positions of power, like in the literary department or even as artistic directors. And you're wondering why they aren't doing more, perhaps, to get sort of women much more front and centre. And there are other things I've thought about this, which are to do with women, the way that women are treated in the theatre. And the odd thing was trying to think of major female parts. And obviously there are plenty of them, but quite a lot of the time they're written by men. In fact, other than Marlene in Top Girls, Carol Churchill's play Top Girls, I couldn't actually think of a major woman part, a sort of something that counts as a major play or a classic, where there's a sort of a woman character. Certainly nothing in the lines of Hedda Gabler or Nora in the Doll's House, or any of Chekhov's women, and even going back to Shakespeare and the Greeks, but obviously the Greeks and Shakespeare were really writing for young men who might one day play sort of the big male parts, although there were obviously specialist women actors in those days. Now, I've got with me Shauna Jones, who is an actress, and what do you think about this, and are there any particular points you want to make?
Hello, Tim. You've covered quite comprehensively the state of play, as it were, this week. Like yourself, I read the article in The Guardian on the 30th of June by Charlotte Higgins, who was talking about women still as bit players in the theatre. And it made me go and actually look at the Equity website and have a look at the notes from the report from the Women's Committee. And in fact, it was back in December last year that they reported that they had attempted to write to 43 companies that had received ACE funding and asked them to report back on the statistics of the gender balance within theatre and the plays that they were doing. And very sadly, the report stated that only 9, as opposed to the 8 quoted in the article in the paper, responses were had. And that was after a second letter was sent out prompting people to actually respond, because people hadn't responded, the companies hadn't responded. So it's very difficult when you read statistics like, for every 2 men on the stage, you get a woman, when you're drawing statistics potentially from only 9 responses from 43 requested letters. So statistics can be used in many ways, but the evidence of what you see on the stage when you go to the theatre with your own eyes is fairly emphatically decisive. And my experience has been that more and more there are performances out there that are all male. And I have to say, I saw both Propeller Productions this year when I was working at the Watermill, and in fact sharing accommodation with most of the company of Propeller. And I have to say, I thought both the productions were excellent. I enjoyed them thoroughly. I'll fess up, I know several people in the cast. And I have no problems with cross-gender casting. I completely agree with Stella Duffy in her article saying that if you're going to create a historically accurate production, that that isn't an argument for having an all-male cast, because there are all sorts of other reasons why it would not be historically accurate. For one thing, the sort of gender balance in the audience. I mean, we now have a 70% female audience, according to some statistics that I've read, and that would certainly not have been the case probably in Elizabethan times, and certainly not in the Greek era. As you said, we come from a background where theatre has been somewhat subjected, if you like, to a patriarchal hegemony. That sounds terribly feminist when I say that. But it's a truth that can't be avoided. And it's interesting, you know, that we call it travesty. It is a travesty. You know, the whole idea of swapping clothes cross-gender on stage, I think, needs to be looked at in terms of purpose. We've got to ask ourselves, what do we benefit from swapping roles? Is it to highlight something in terms of the politics of a piece? Or is it to be historically accurate? And if that part is allowed, well, then surely the rest must be made to be historically accurate as well. Certainly, again, talking historically, theatre has always been there to, in a sense, reflect society. And in that case, we've got to have a look at a society that, okay, if you consider that women didn't have the vote until 1928, and the campaigning sort of first started when, you know, John Stuart Mill's put it to Parliament in his Reform Act in 1865. And, you know, it took them 63 years of really vigorous campaigning to get the vote. You talk about even equal pay now. The Equal Pay Act was introduced in 1970. But an article in The Guardian in 2010 stated that the Chartered Management Institute data showed that gender wage differentials were still very wide and weren't likely to reach equal pay until 2057. So that's a battle of 87 years on our hands if we're looking for equal pay. So even when you look at the Sex Discrimination Act, because I think you have to look at these things when you're talking about parity. In the Sex Discrimination Act, which came in 1975, in Article 7, if I'm allowed to quote, it says, it does not apply to any employment where being a man is a genuine occupational qualification for the job, and more specifically in Clause 2, where being a man is a genuine occupational qualification for a job only where the essential nature of the job calls for a man for reasons of physiology, excluding physical strength or stamina, or in dramatic performances or other entertainment, for reasons of authenticity, so that the essential nature of the job would be materially different if carried out by a woman. Now, the reason I wanted to bring that up is not because I disagree with that in essence, that there should be situations where, of course, a woman's role should be played by a woman or a man's role should be played by a man or even vice versa. But the point I want to pick up here is I'm quoting from the Sex Discrimination Act, and in every instance here, it's talking about that it does not apply where a man, being a man, is a genuine occupational qualification. At no point does it ever offer the reverse, where it says where being a woman is a genuine occupational qualification for the job. So what I'm trying to point out here is it's actually to do with a mindset that we have. And the mindset that we have is that even in our legislation, in our legislative documentation, it's worded from the point of view of men. So having pointed out that it's taken years of campaigning to get the vote, we still haven't got equal pay. Sex discrimination documentation is geared in favour of men in terms of how it's laid out. And given that theatre reflects society, perhaps we've got a bigger fight on our hands. All this having been said, I know very little about these things. My experience is entirely really in theatre. But my question is, where are the Rooster Byron roles for women? And why is it that as women grow older, they disappear from the stage? And equally, why is it that we're so fascinated with seeing men in drag or in transgender clothing, in travesti, and less so interested in serious roles where women cross-dress? I mean, I can think there are good examples. For example, I know Catherine Hunter recently in The Bee was playing a very strong sort of character and dressed as a man. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see the performance, but I was aware of it.
Yeah, we talked about The Bee on the show. It's a very good show. It was a very good show. And, of course, Catherine Hunter is an actress who has done quite a lot of male roles. She's played Richard III and King Lear. I always used to say she was my favourite King Lear.
Yes.
Sorry, please carry on.
No. I welcome the interjection. what I wanted to say was that I think it's really important whenever there is a shortfall discovered or where we discover there is something that's wrong that needs to be righted. And I will cite as examples a campaign such as Stonewall or the early days of feminism, when people were trying to fight to right something that had become imbalanced and where there was discrimination, that there has to be a bit of noise at the beginning. One has to make a bit of a campaign. You have to push a little bit harder in order to find parity, in order to find equality, in order that we don't have to think of it as being an unusual thing and we don't have to make a special effort to find those roles, to find those plays, in order to make sure that the balance is redressed. But unfortunately, initially there has to be a bit of noise made before that circumstance can come about. On the other hand, I'm very keen that there should not be a prescriptive policy towards theatre companies that they have to find and that they are only able to stage plays in particular ways. I would hate to see the innovative and exciting work that Propeller do disappear purely because of having to follow policy. I think it's damning because it would be censorship in the worst kind of way of creative freedom of expression. They want to say something very particular. They want to show something very particular. And I think to try and prescribe answers in that sense is very tricky, a very tricky road to tread and quite dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the sort of the cross-gender casting, I mean, I would happily watch, I'd probably name a dozen actresses I would happily watch playing something like Uncle Vanya. I have no problem about that. I would have no interest in a man playing something like Hedda Gabler, why would I want to watch something like that? But, I mean, there is this thing that I really want to see women producing strong women, and also, as you say, not it's kind of not wanting women to be playing roles where it's always because of the man, because men don't have that problem. They don't get that.
But
that,
historically, going back as far back as Western theatre as we can think of, you know, in 550 BC, when they first started making the plays, there weren't even women on the stage. I'm not talking about female actors. There weren't even female characters initially. I mean, I don't think it was until 30-odd years in when that happened. One of the playwrights was very bold, and he put a female on the stage to great uproar, played, of course, by a man. Since then, we have generally been accessories or people's downfalls or plot devices. That's basically been the situation for women within plays, in the early plays.
Certainly, I mean, in tragedy, you get an awful lot of things where you know, if you're looking at the way that men are treated, is that they are treated, they are sort of in a position where their power is being diminished, or they're not living up to their power. And nobody has really written an awful lot of roles where women are like that. I mean, the one I would keep coming back to, I think, is something like Hedda Gabler, where this is a woman who was sort of powerful and strong because she was the daughter of she's the daughter of the general, and she was the sort of the top person where she lived. And then suddenly she's little Frau Tesman, and she's suddenly, she's been diminished, and she's fighting against that. And that is actually almost a male role. In many ways. I mean, that's often, more a sort of a role that you'd have with a man. And I do wonder if, where are people creating roles like that, where, as you say, they're not an accessory, they're not subject to the tyranny of men, or that's a bit strong, but, where are they, and why aren't they being produced, and are they being written? And if they're being written, why aren't they being produced, or why aren't they being written? I mean, obviously, we live in a male-dominated society still, and we still live in a world which is largely male and white, and the people in control are largely male and white. And if you're going to reflect anything to do with power, you're going to have to deal with people who are male and white. Yeah. And it does make it difficult, but I don't know that the women are doing it. And it's especially women writers. You know, where are they? Because I can't actually think of too many. I mean, obviously Carol Churchill, but where are the others?
I think they're coming forward, but I think But part of the problem has also been that when, a woman is trying to break into a man's world of writing or production or direction, the last thing that many of them want to do is ghettoise themselves by making a stand that early on. Very few people do. I also think what it comes down to for a lot of people is that there are stories they want to tell. And sometimes for playwrights, you have to look, if the burning thing for them isn't a particular political outlook or agenda, but just a story that they want to tell, it's very difficult then to try and shoehorn in issues or agendas into, a first-time story that you're trying to tell, or, trying to make your way your own success. I do think there are playwrights out there who are aware. For example, Mike Bartlett, I think, is quite fair in his work, in the way that he writes for women as well. As you know, I know 13 pretty well. And the fact that he made the Prime Minister female in that piece, and actually a very sympathetic character as well, despite the fact that she was a Tory Prime Minister. To everybody's surprise, he wrote for her in a way that made her an extremely powerful, strong, intelligent, warm, sympathetic individual. He wrote a really lovely character. So the roles are out there. They're just so few and far between. I also think that with regards to all the recent funding cuts that have happened, that a theatre that is trying to be different, new theatre that's trying to be made, requires seed funding at some level to develop. And I think there's a lot of pressure on companies to produce things that are going to be more commercially successful in order that the companies can survive. And perhaps what is really needed is some seed funding for work specifically that's going to move the agenda forward for women in theatre.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast page in Facebook, on the web, We are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found in iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.